Is he living? One other nod. Is he in London? He gave me one other nod, compressed the post office exceedingly, gave me one last nod, and went on with his breakfast. Now, said Wemmick, questioning being over, which he emphasized and repeated for my guidance, I come to what I did after hearing what I heard. I went to Garden Court to find you. Not finding you, I went to Clarica's to find Mr. Herbert. And him you found? Said I with great anxiety. And him I found. Without mentioning any names or going into any details, I gave him to understand that if he was aware of anybody, Tom, Jack, or Richard, being about the chambers, or about the immediate neighbourhood, he'd better get Tom, Jack, or Richard out of the way while you were out of the way. He would be greatly puzzled what to do. He was puzzled what to do. Not the less because I gave him my opinion that it was not safe to try to get Tom, Jack, or Richard too far out of the way at present. Mr. Pip, I'll tell you something. Under existing circumstances, there is no place like a great city when you are once in it. Don't break cover too soon. Lie close. Wait till things slacken before you try the open, even for foreign air. I thanked him for this valuable advice, and asked him what Herbert had done. "Mr. Herbert," said Wemmick, after being all of a heap for half an hour, struck out a plan. He mentioned to me as a secret that he was courting a young lady who has, as you no doubt are aware, a bedridden pa, which pa, having been in the purser's line of life, lies abed in a bow window where he can see the ships sail up and down the river. You are acquainted with the young lady, most probably? Not personally, said I. The truth was that she had objected to me as an expensive companion who did Herbert no good, and that when Herbert had first proposed to present me to her, she had received the proposal with such very moderate warmth that Herbert had felt himself obliged to confide the state of the case to me, with a view to the lapse of a little time before I made her acquaintance. When I had begun to advance Herbert's prospects by stealth, I had been able to bear this with cheerful philosophy. He and his affianced, for their part, had naturally not been very anxious to introduce a third person into their interviews. And thus, although I was assured that I had risen in Clara's esteem, and although the young lady and I had long regularly interchanged messages and remembrances by Herbert, I had never seen her. However, I did not trouble Wemmick with those particulars. "The house with the bow window," said Wemmick, "being by the riverside, down the pool there between Limehouse and Greenwich, and being kept, it seems, by a very respectable widow who has a furnished upper floor to let, Mr. Herbert put it to me, what did I think of that as a temporary tenement for Tom, Jack, or Richard? Now, I thought very well of it, for three reasons I'll give you. That is to say, firstly, it's altogether out of all your beats, and is well away from the usual heap of streets, great and small. Secondly, without going near it yourself, you could always hear of the safety of Tom, Jack, or Richard through Mr. Herbert. Thirdly, after a while, and when it might be prudent, if you should want to slip Tom, Jack, or Richard on board a foreign packet boat, there he is, ready." Much comforted by these considerations, I thanked Wemmick again and again, and begged him to proceed. "Well, sir, Mr. Herbert threw himself into the business with a will, and by 9 o'clock last night he housed Tom, Jack, or Richard, whichever it may be, you and I don't want to know, quite successfully. At the old lodgings it was understood that he was summoned to Dover, and in fact he was taken down the Dover Road and cornered out of it. Now, another great advantage of all this is that it was done without you, and when, if anyone was concerning himself about your movements, you must be known to be ever so many miles off, and quite otherwise engaged. This diverts suspicion and confuses it, and for the same reason I recommend it that even if you came back last night you should not go home. It brings in more confusion, and you want confusion." Wemmick, having finished his breakfast, Here looked at his watch, and began to get his coat on. "Now, Mr. Pip," said he, with his hands still in the sleeves, "I have probably done the most I can do. But if I can ever do more, from a Woolworth point of view, and in a strictly private and personal capacity, I shall be glad to do it. Here's the address. There can be no harm in your going here tonight and seeing for yourself that all is well with Tom, Jack, or Richard before you go home, which is another reason for your not going home last night. But after you have gone home, don't go back here. You are very welcome, I am sure, Mr. Pip." His hands were now out of his sleeves, and I was shaking them. "And let me finally impress one important point upon you." He laid his hands upon my shoulders, and added in a solemn whisper, "Avail yourself of this evening to lay hold of his portable property. You don't know what may happen to him. Don't let anything happen to the portable property." Quite despairing of making my mind clear to Wemmick on this point, I forbore to try. "Time's up," said Wemmick, "and I must be off. If you had nothing more pressing to do than to keep here till dark, that's what I should advise. You look very much worried, and it would do you good to have a perfectly quiet day with the aged. He'll be up presently, and a little bit of, you remember the pig?"
"Of course," said I.
"Well, and a little bit of him. That sausage you toasted was his, and he was in all respects a first-rater. Do try him, if it is only for old acquaintance sake. Goodbye, aged parent," in a cheery shout.
"All right, John, all right, my boy," piped the old man from within.
I soon fell asleep before Wemmick's fire, and the aged and I enjoyed one another's society by falling asleep before it more or less all day. We had a loin of pork for dinner, and greens grown on the estate, and I nodded at the aged with a good intention whenever I failed to do it drowsily. When it was quite dark, I left the aged preparing the fire for toast, and I inferred from the number of teacups, as well as from his glances at the two little doors on the wall, that Miss Skiffins was expected.
Chapter 46. 8 o'clock had struck before I got into the air that was scented, not disagreeably, by the chips and shavings of the longshore boatbuilders and mast, oar, and blockmakers. All that waterside region of the upper and lower pool below bridge was unknown ground to me, and when I struck down by the river, I found that the spot I wanted was not where I had supposed it to be, and was anything but easy to find. It was called Mill Pond Bank, Chink's Basin, and I had no other guide to Chink's Basin than the old green copper rope walk. It matters not what stranded ships repairing in dry docks I lost myself among, what old hulls of ships in course of being knocked to pieces, what ooze and slime and other dregs of tide, what yards of shipbuilders and shipbreakers, what rusty anchors blindly biting into the ground, though for years off duty, what mountainous country of accumulated casks and timber, how many rope walks that were not the old green copper. After several times falling short of my destination, and as often overshooting it, I came unexpectedly round a corner upon Mill Pond Bank. It was a fresh kind of place, all circumstances considered, where the wind from the river had room to turn itself round, and there was two or three trees in it, and there was a stump of a ruined windmill, and there was the old green copper rope walk, whose long and narrow vista I could trace in the moonlight, among a series of wooden frames set in the ground that looked like superannuated haymaking rakes which had grown old and lost most of their teeth. Selecting from the few queer houses upon Mill Pond Bank, a house with a wooden front and three stories of bow window, not bay window, which is another thing, I looked at the plate upon the door, and read there, Mrs. Wimple. That being the name I wanted, I knocked, and an elderly woman of a pleasant and thriving appearance responded. She was immediately deposed, however, by Herbert, who silently led me into the parlour and shut the door. It was an odd sensation to see this very familiar face established quite at home in that very unfamiliar room and region, and I found myself looking at him as I looked at the corner cupboard with the glass and china the shells upon the chimney-piece, and the coloured engravings on the wall representing the death of Captain Cook, a ship launch, and His Majesty, King George III, in a state coachman's wig, leather breeches, and top boots on a terrace at Windsor. "All is well, Handel," said Herbert, "and he's quite satisfied, though eager to see you. My dear girl is with her father, and if you'll wait till she comes down, I'll make you known to her, and then we'll go upstairs. That's her father." I had become aware of an alarming growling overhead, and had probably expressed the fact in my countenance. "I'm afraid he is a sad old rascal," said Herbert, smiling. "But I have never seen him. Don't you smell rum? He's always at it." "At rum?" said I. "Yes," returned Herbert, "and you may suppose how mild it makes his gout. He persists, too, in keeping all the provisions upstairs in his room, and serving them out. He keeps them on shelves over his head, and will weigh them all. His room must be like a chandler's shop." While he thus spoke, the growling noise became a prolonged roar, and then died away. "What else can be the consequence," said Herbert in explanation, "if he will cut the cheese? A man with the gout in his right hand, and everywhere else, can't expect to get through a double Gloucester without hurting himself." He seemed to have hurt himself very much, for he gave another furious roar. "To have Provis for an upper lodger is quite a godsend to Mrs. Wimple," said Herbert, "for of course people in general won't stand that noise. A curious place, Handel, isn't it?" It was a curious place indeed, but remarkably well kept and clean. "Mrs. Wimple," said Herbert when I told him so, "is the best of housewives, and I really do not know what my Clara would do without her motherly help. For Clara has no mother of her own, Handel, and no relation in the world but old Gruff and Grim." "Surely that's not his name, Herbert?" No, said Herbert. "That's my name for him. His name is Mr. Barley. But what a blessing it is for the son of my father and mother to love a girl who has no relations, and who can never bother herself or anybody else about her family." Herbert had told me on former occasions, and now reminded me, that he first knew Miss Clara Barley when she was completing her education at an establishment at Hammersmith, and that on her being recalled home to nurse her father, he and she had confided their affection to the motherly Mrs. Wimple, by whom it had been fostered and regulated with equal kindness and discretion ever since. It was understood that nothing of a tender nature could possibly be confided to old Barley, by reason of his being totally unequal to the consideration of any subject more psychological than gout, rum, and purser's stores. As we were thus conversing in a low tone, while old Barley's sustained growl vibrated in the beam that crossed the ceiling, the room door opened, and a very pretty, slight, dark-eyed girl of 20 or so came in with a basket in her hand, whom Herbert tenderly relieved of the basket, and presented, blushing, as Clara. She really was a most charming girl, and might have passed for a captive fairy whom that truculent ogre, old Barley, had pressed into his service. "Look here," said Herbert, showing me the basket, with a compassionate and tender smile after we had talked a little. "Here's poor Clara's supper, served out every night. Here's her allowance of bread, and here's her slice of cheese, and here's her rum, which I drink. This is Mr. Barley's breakfast for tomorrow, served out to be cooked. 2 mutton chops, 3 potatoes, some split peas, a little flour, 2 ounces of butter, a pinch of salt, and all this black pepper. It's stewed up together and taken hot, and it's a nice thing for the gout, I should think." There was something so natural and winning in Clara's resigned way of looking at these stores in detail as Herbert pointed them out, and something so confiding, loving, and innocent in her modest manner of yielding herself to Herbert's embracing arm, and something so gentle in her, so much needing protection on Mill Pond Bank by Chink's Basin and the old green copper rope walk, with old Barley growling in the beam, that I would not have undone the engagement between her and Herbert for all the money in the pocket-book I had never opened. I was looking at her with pleasure and admiration, when suddenly the growl swelled into a roar again, and a frightful bumping noise was heard above, as if a giant with a wooden leg were trying to bore it through the ceiling to come at us. Upon this, Clara said to Herbert, "Papa wants me, darling," and ran away. "There's an unconscionable old shark for you," said Herbert. "What do you suppose he wants now, Handel?" "I don't know," said I. "Something to drink?"
"That's it," cried Herbert, as if I had made a guess of extraordinary merit. "He keeps his grog ready mixed in a little tub on the table. Wait a moment, and you'll hear Clara lift him up to take some. There he goes." Another roar with a prolonged shake at the end. "Now," said Herbert, as it was succeeded by silence, "he's drinking." "Now," said Herbert, as the growl resounded in the beam once more, "he's down again on his back." Clara returned soon afterwards, and Herbert accompanied me upstairs to see our charge. As we passed Mr. Barley's door, he was heard hoarsely muttering within, in a strain that rose and fell like wind, the following refrain, in which I substitute good wishes for something quite the reverse.
"Ay, bless your eyes, here's old Bill Barley. Here's old Bill Barley, bless your eyes. Here's old Bill Barley on the flat of his back, by the Lord, lying on the flat of his back like a drifting old dead flounder. Here's your old Bill Barley, bless your eyes. Ay, bless you."
In this strain of consolation, Herbert informed me the invisible Barley would commune with himself by the day and night together, often while it was light, having at the same time one eye at a telescope, which was fitted on his bed for the convenience of sweeping the river. In his two cabin rooms at the top of the house, which were fresh and airy, and in which Mr. Barley was less audible than below, I found Provis comfortably settled. He expressed no alarm, and seemed to feel none that was worth mentioning, but it struck me that he was softened, indefinably, for I could not have said how, and could never afterwards recall how, when I tried, but certainly. The opportunity that the day's rest had given me for reflection had resulted in my fully determining to say nothing to him respecting Compeyson. For anything I knew, his animosity towards the man might otherwise lead to his seeking him out and rushing on his own destruction. Therefore, when Herbert and I sat down with him by his fire, I asked him first of all whether he relied on Wemmick's judgment and sources of information.
"Ah, dear boy," he answered with a grave nod. "Jaggers knows."
"Then I have talked with Wemmick," said I, "and have come to tell you what caution he gave me and what advice." This I did accurately, with the reservation just mentioned, and I told him how Wemmick had heard in Newgate Prison, whether from officers or prisoners I could not say, that he was under some suspicion, and that my chambers had been watched. How Wemmick had recommended his keeping close for a time, and my keeping away from him, and what Wemmick had said about getting him abroad. I added that, of course, when the time came, I should go with him, or should follow close upon him, as might be safest in Wemmick's judgment. What was to follow that I did not touch upon. Neither, indeed, was I at all clear or comfortable about it in my own mind, now that I saw him in that softer condition, and in declared peril for my sake. As to altering my way of living by enlarging my expenses, I put it to him whether in our present unsettled and difficult circumstances it would not be simply ridiculous if it were no worse. He could not deny this, and indeed was very reasonable throughout. His coming back was a venture, he said, and he had always known it to be a venture. He would do nothing to make it a desperate venture, and he had very little to fear of his safety with such good help. Herbert, who had been looking at the fire and pondering, here said something that had come into his thoughts arising out of Wemmick's suggestion, which it might be worthwhile to pursue. "We are both good watermen, Handel, and could take him down the river ourselves when the right time comes. No boat would then be hired for the purpose, and no boatmen. That would save at least a chance of suspicion, and any chance is worth saving. And never mind the season, don't you think it might be a good thing if you began at once to keep a boat at the foot of the temple stairs, and were in the habit of rowing up and down the river? You fall into that habit, and then who notices or minds? Do it 20 or 50 times, and there is nothing special in your doing it the 21st or 51st. I liked this scheme, and Provis was quite elated by it. We agreed that it should be carried into execution, and that Provis should never recognize us if we came below bridge and rowed past Millpond Bank. But we further agreed that he should pull down the blind in that part of his window which gave upon the east whenever he saw us, and all was right. Our conference being now ended and everything arranged, I rose to go, remarking to Herbert that he and I had better not go home together,
and that I would take half an hour's start of him. "I don't like to leave you here," I said to Provis, "though I cannot doubt your being safer here than near me. Goodbye."
"Dear boy," he answered, clasping my hands, "I don't know when we may meet again, and I don't like goodbye. Say good night."
"Good night. Herbert will go regularly between us, and when the time comes, you may be certain I shall be ready. Good night. Good night." We thought it best that he should stay in his own rooms, and we left him on the landing outside his door, holding a light over the stair rail to light us downstairs. Looking back at him, I thought of the first night of his return, when our positions were reversed, and when I little supposed my heart would ever be as heavy and anxious at parting from him as it was now. Old Barley was growling and swearing when we repassed his door, with no appearance of having ceased or of meaning to cease. When we got to the foot of the stairs, I asked Herbert whether he had preserved the name of Provis. He replied, "Certainly not," and that the lodger was Mr. Campbell. He also explained that the utmost known of Mr. Campbell there was that he, Herbert, had Mr. Campbell consigned to him, and felt a strong personal interest in his being well cared for, and living a secluded life. So when he went into the parlour where Mrs. Wimple and Clara were seated at work, I said nothing of my own interest in Mr. Campbell, but kept it to myself. When I had taken leave of the pretty, gentle, dark-eyed girl, and the motherly woman who had not outlived her honest sympathy with a little affair of true love, I felt as if the old green copper rope-walk had grown quite a different place. Old Barley might be as old as the hills, and might swear like a whole field of troopers, but there were redeeming youth and trust and hope enough in Chink's Basin to fill it to overflowing. And then I thought of Estella, and of our parting, and went home very sadly. All things were as quiet in the temple as ever I had seen them. The windows of the rooms of that side, lately occupied by Provis, were dark and still, and there was no lounger in Garden Court. I walked past the fountain twice or thrice before I descended the steps that were between me and my rooms. But I was quite alone. Herbert, coming to my bedside when he came in, for I went straight to bed, dispirited and fatigued, made the same report. Opening one of the windows after that, he looked out into the moonlight and told me that the pavement was as solemnly empty as the pavement of any cathedral at that same hour. Next day, I set myself to get the boat. It was soon done, and the boat was brought round to the temple stairs and lay where I could reach her within a minute or two. Then I began to go out as for training and practice, sometimes alone, sometimes with Herbert. I was often out in cold, rain, and sleet, but nobody took much note of me after I had been out a few times. At first, I kept above Blackfriars Bridge, but as the hours of the tide changed, I took towards London Bridge. It was old London Bridge in those days, and at certain states of the tide there was a race and a fall of water there which gave it a bad reputation. But I knew well enough how to shoot the bridge, after seeing it done, and so began to row about among the shipping in the pool, and down to the Erith. The first time I passed Mill Pond Bank, Herbert and I were pulling a pair of oars, and both in going and returning, we saw the blind towards the east came down. Herbert was rarely there less frequently than 3 times in a week, and he never brought me a single word of intelligence that was at all alarming. Still, I knew that there was cause for alarm, and I could not get rid of the notion of being watched. Once received, it is a haunting idea. How many undesigning persons I suspected of watching me, it would be hard to calculate. In short, I was always full of fears for the rash man who was in hiding. Herbert had sometimes said to me that he found it pleasant to stand at one of our windows after dark when the tide was running down, and to think that it was flowing, with everything it bore, towards Clara. But I thought with dread that it was flowing towards Magwitch, and that any black mark on its surface might be his pursuers going swiftly, silently, and surely to take him. Chapter 47. Some weeks passed without bringing any change. We waited for Wemmick, and he made no sign. If I had never known him out of Little Britain, and had never enjoyed the privilege of being on a familiar footing at the castle, I might have doubted him. Not so for a moment, knowing him as I did. My worldly affairs began to wear a gloomy appearance, and I was pressed for money by more than one creditor. Even I myself began to know the want of money, I mean of ready money in my own pocket, and to relieve it by converting some easily spared articles of jewellery into cash. But I had quite determined that it would be a heartless fraud to take more money from my patron in the existing state of my uncertain thoughts and plans. Therefore, I had sent him the unopened pocketbook by Herbert to hold it in his own keeping, and I felt a kind of satisfaction, whether it was a false kind or a true, I hardly know, in not having profited by his generosity since his revelation of himself. As the time wore on, an impression settled heavily upon me that Estella was married. Fearful of having it confirmed, though it was all but a conviction, I avoided the newspapers, and begged Herbert, to whom I had confided the circumstances of our last interview, never to speak of her to me. Why I hoarded up this last wretched little rag of the robe of hope that was rent and given to the winds, how do I know? Why did you, who read this, commit that not dissimilar inconsistency of your own last year, last month, last week? It was an unhappy life that I lived, and its one dominant anxiety, towering over all its other anxieties, like a high mountain above a range of mountains, never disappeared from my view. Still, no new cause for fear arose. Let me start from my bed as I would, with the terror fresh upon me that he was discovered. Let me sit listening as I would, with dread for Herbert's returning step at night, lest it should be fleeter than ordinary and winged with evil news. For all that, and much more to like purpose, the round of things went on. Condemned to inaction and a state of constant restlessness and suspense, I rowed about in my boat and waited. Waited, waited, as I best could. There were states of the tide when, having been down the river, I could not get back through the eddy-chafed arches and starlings of old London Bridge. Then I left my boat at a wharf near the Custom House, to be brought up afterwards to the Temple Stairs. I was not averse to doing this, as it served to make me and my boat a commoner incident among the waterside people there. From this slight occasion sprang two meetings that I have now to tell of. One afternoon, late in the month of February, I came ashore at the wharf at dusk. I had pulled down as far as Greenwich with the ebb tide, and had turned with the tide. It had been a fine, bright day, but it had become foggy as the sun dropped, and I had to feel my way back among the shipping pretty carefully. Both in going and returning, I had seen the signal in his window. All well. As it was a raw evening and I was cold, I thought I would comfort myself with dinner at once, and as I had hours of dejection and solitude before me if I went home to the Temple, I thought I would afterwards go to the play. The theatre, where Mr. Wopsle had achieved his questionable triumph, was in that waterside neighbourhood. It is nowhere now, and to that theatre I resolved to go. I was aware that Mr. Wopsle had not succeeded in reviving the drama, but on the contrary, had rather partaken of its decline. He had been ominously heard of, through the playbills, as a faithful black in connection with a little girl of noble birth and a monkey, and Herbert had seen him as a predatory tartar of comic propensities, with a face like a red brick and an outrageous hat all over bells. I dined at what Herbert and I used to call a geographical chop-house, where there were maps of the world in porter-pot rims on every half-yard of the tablecloths, and charts of gravy on every one of the knives. To this day there is scarcely a single chop-house within the Lord Mayor's dominions which is not geographical, and wore out the time in dozing over crumbs, staring at gas, and baking in a hot blast of dinners. By and by I roused myself and went to the play. There I found a virtuous boatswain in His Majesty's service, a most excellent man, though I could have wished his trousers not quite so tight in some places, and not quite so loose in others, who knocked all the little men's hats over their eyes, though he was very generous and brave, and wouldn't hear of anybody's paying taxes, though he was very patriotic. He had a bag of money in his pocket, like a pudding in the cloth, and on that property married a young person in bed furniture, with great rejoicings. The whole population of Portsmouth, 9 in number at the last census, turning out on the beach to rub their own hands and shake everybody else's, and sing, "Fill, fill!" A certain dark-complexioned swab, however, who wouldn't fill or do anything else that was proposed to him, and whose heart was openly stated by the boatswain to be as black as his figurehead, proposed to two other swabs to get all mankind into difficulties, which was so effectually done, the swab family having considerable political influence, that it took half the evening to set things right. And then it was only brought about through an honest little grocer with a white hat, black gaiters, and red nose, getting into a clock with a gridiron and listening, and coming out and knocking everybody down from behind with a gridiron whom he couldn't confute with what he'd overheard. This led to Mr. Wopsles, who had never been heard of before, coming in with a star and garter on as a plenipotentiary of great power direct from the Admiralty, to say that the swabs were all to go to prison on the spot, and that he had brought the boatswain down the Union Jack as a slight acknowledgement of his public services. The boatswain, unmanned for the first time, respectfully dried his eyes on the jack, and then cheering up and addressing Mr. Wopsle as Your Honour, solicited permission to take him by the fin. Mr. Wopsle, conceding his fin with a gracious dignity, was immediately shoved into a dusty corner while everybody danced a hornpipe, and from that corner, surveying the public with a discontented eye, became aware of me. The second piece was the last new grand comic Christmas pantomime, in the first scene of which it pained me to suspect that I detected Mr. Wopsle with red worsted legs under a highly magnified phosphoric countenance and a shock of red curtain fringe for his hair, engaged in the manufacture of thunderbolts in a mine, and displaying great cowardice when his gigantic master came home, very hoarse, to dinner. But he presently presented himself under worthier circumstances, for the genius of youthful love being in want of assistance, on account of the parental brutality of an ignorant farmer who opposed the choice of his daughter's heart, by purposely falling upon the object in a flour sack out of the first-floor window, summoned a sententious enchanter, and he, coming up from the Antipodes rather unsteadily after an apparently violent journey, proved to be Mr. Wopsle in a high-crowned hat, with a necromantic work in one volume under his arm. The business of this enchanter on earth being principally to be talked at, sung at, butted at, danced at, and flashed at with fires of various colours, he had a good deal of time on his hands, and I observed with great surprise that he devoted it to staring in my direction as if he were lost in amazement. There was something so remarkable in the increasing glare of Mr. Wopsle's eye, and he seemed to be turning so many things over in his mind, and to grow so confused, that I could not make it out. I sat thinking of it long after he had ascended to the clouds in a large watch-case, and still I could not make it out. I was still thinking of it when I came out of the theatre an hour afterwards, and found him waiting for me near the door. "How do you do?" said I, shaking hands with him as we turned down the street together. "I saw that you saw me."
"Saw you, Mr. Pip?" he returned. "Yes, of course I saw you. But who else was there?"
"Who else?"
"It is the strangest thing," said Mr. Wopsle, drifting into his lost look again. "And yet I could swear to him."
Becoming alarmed, I entreated Mr. Wopsle to explain his meaning.
"Whether I should have noticed him at first, but for your being there," said Mr. Wopsle, going on in the same lost way, "I can't be positive. Yet I think I should."
Involuntarily I looked round me, as I was accustomed to look round me when I went home, for these mysterious words gave me a chill.
"Oh, he can't be in sight," said Mr. Wopsle. "He went out before I went off. I saw him go."
Having the reason that I had for being suspicious, I even suspected this poor actor. I mistrusted a design to entrap me into some admission. Therefore I glanced at him as we walked on together, but said nothing.
"I had a ridiculous fancy that he must be with you, Mr. Pip, till I saw that you were quite unconscious of him, sitting behind you there, like a ghost."
My former chill crept over me again, but I was resolved not to speak yet, for it was quite consistent with his words that he might be set on to induce me to connect these references with Provis. Of course, I was perfectly sure and safe that Provis had not been there.
"I dare say you wonder at me, Mr. Pip. Indeed, I see you do. But it is so very strange. You'll hardly believe what I am going to tell you. I could hardly believe it myself if you told me."
"Indeed," said I.
"No, indeed, Mr. Pip. You remember in old times a certain Christmas day when you were quite a child, and I dined at Gargery's, and some soldiers came to the door to get a pair of handcuffs mended?
I remember it very well.
And you remember that there was a chase after two convicts, and that we joined in it, and that Gargery took you on his back, and that I took the lead, and you kept up with me as well as you could.
I remember it all very well.
Better than he thought, except the last clause.
And you remember that we came up with the two in a ditch, and that there was a scuffle between them, and that one of them had been severely handled and much mauled about the face by the other.
I see it all before me.
And that the soldiers lighted torches and put the two in the centre, and that we went on to see the last of them over the black marshes with the torchlight shining on their faces.
I am particular about that.
With the torchlight shining on their faces, when there was an outer ring of dark night all about us.
Yes, said I, I remember all that.
Then, Mr. Pip, one of those two prisoners sat behind you tonight. I saw him over your shoulder.
Steady, I thought. I asked him then, which of the two do you suppose you saw?
The one who had been mauled, he answered readily. And I'll swear I saw him. The more I think of him, the more certain I am of him.
This is very curious, said I, with the best assumption I could put on, of its being nothing more to me. Very curious indeed. I cannot exaggerate the enhanced disquiet into which this conversation threw me, or the special and peculiar terror I felt at Compeyson's having been behind me like a ghost. For if he had ever been out of my thoughts for a few moments together since the hiding had begun, it was in those very moments when he was closest to me, and to think that I should be so unconscious and off my guard after all my care was as if I had shut an avenue of 100 doors to keep him out, and then had found him at my elbow. I could not doubt either that he was there, because I was there, and that however slight an appearance of danger there might be about us, danger was always near and active. I put such questions to Mr. Wopsle as, when did the man come in? He could not tell me that. He saw me, and over my shoulder he saw the man. It was not until he had seen him for some time that he began to identify him, but he had from the first vaguely associated him with me, and known him as somehow belonging to me in the old village time. How was he dressed? Prosperously, but not noticeably otherwise. He thought in black. Was his face at all disfigured? No, he believed not. I believed not, too, for although in my brooding state I had taken no especial notice of the people behind me, I thought it likely that a face at all disfigured would have attracted my attention. When Mr. Wopsle had imparted to me all that he could recall, or I extract, and when I had treated him to a little appropriate refreshment after the fatigues of the evening, we parted. It was between 12 and 1 o'clock when I reached the temple, and the gates were shut. No one was near me when I went in and went home. Herbert had come in, and we held a very serious council by the fire, but there was nothing to be done, saving to communicate to Wemmick what I had that night found out, and to remind him that we waited for his hint. As I thought that I might compromise him if I went too often to the castle, I made this communication by letter. I wrote it before I went to bed, and went out and posted it, and again no one was near me. Herbert and I agreed that we could do nothing else but be very cautious, and we were very cautious indeed, more cautious than before, if that were possible, and I, for my part, never went near Chink's Basin, except when I rode by, and then I only looked at Mill Pond Bank as I looked at anything else.
Chapter 48. The second of the two meetings referred to in the last chapter occurred about a week after the first. I had again left my boat at the wharf below bridge. The time was an hour earlier in the afternoon, and undecided where to dine, I had strolled up into Cheapside, and was strolling along it, surely the most unsettled person in all the busy concourse, when a large hand was laid upon my shoulder by someone overtaking me. It was Mr. Jagger's hand, and he passed it through my arm.
As we are going in the same direction, Pip, we may walk together. Where are you bound for?
For the temple, I think, said I.
Don't you know? Said Mr. Jaggers.
Well, I returned, glad for once to get the better of him in cross-examination, I do not know, for I have not made up my mind.
You are going to dine, said Mr. Jaggers. You don't mind admitting that, I suppose?
No, I returned. I don't mind admitting that.
And are not engaged?
I don't mind admitting also that I am not engaged.
Then, said Mr. Jaggers, come and dine with me.
I was going to excuse myself when he added,
Wemmick's coming.
So I changed my excuse into an acceptance, the few words I had uttered serving for the beginning of either, and we went along Cheapside and slanted off to Little Britain, while the lights were springing up brilliantly in the shop windows, and the street lamplighters, scarcely finding ground enough to plant their ladders on in the midst of the afternoon's bustle, were skipping up and down and running in and out, opening more red eyes in the gathering fog than my rushlight tower at the Hummums had opened white eyes in the ghostly wall. At the office in Little Britain there was the usual letter-writing, hand-washing, candle-snuffing, and safe-locking that closed the business of the day. As I stood idle by Mr. Jagger's fire, its rising and falling flame made the two casts on the shelf look as if they were playing a diabolical game at bo-peep with me, while the pair of coarse, fat office candles that dimly lighted Mr. Jaggers as he wrote in a corner were decorated with dirty winding sheets, as if in remembrance of a host of hanged clients. We went to Gerrard Street, all three together, in a hackney coach, and as soon as we got there, dinner was served. Although I should not have thought of making, in that place, the most distant reference by so much as a look to Wemmick's Woolworth sentiments, yet I should have had no objection to catching his eye now and then in a friendly way. But it was not to be done. He turned his eyes on Mr. Jaggers whenever he raised them from the table, and was as dry and distant to me as if there were twin Wemmicks, and this was the wrong one.
"Did you send that note of Miss Havisham's to Mr. Pip Wemmick?"
Mr. Jaggers asked, soon after we began dinner.
"No, sir," returned Wemmick.
"It was going by post when you brought Mr. Pip into the office. Here it is." He handed it to his principal, instead of to me.
"It's a note of 2 lines, Pip," said Mr. Jaggers, handing it on. "Sent up to me by Miss Havisham on account of her not being sure of your address. She tells me that she wants to see you on a little matter of business you mentioned to her. You'll go down?"
"Yes," said I, casting my eyes over the note, which was exactly in those terms.
"When do you think of going down?"
"I have an impending engagement," said I, glancing at Wemmick, who was putting fish into the post-office, "that renders me rather uncertain of my time. At once, I think."
"If Mr. Pip has the intention of going at once," said Wemmick to Mr. Jaggers, "he needn't write an answer, you know."
Receiving this as an intimation that it was best not to delay, I settled that I would go tomorrow, and said so. Wemmick drank a glass of wine, and looked with a grimly satisfied air at Mr. Jaggers, but not at me.
"So, Pip, our friend the Spider," said Mr. Jaggers, "has played his cards. He has won the pool."
It was as much as I could do to assent.
"Ah, he is a promising fellow, in his way. But he may not have it all his own way. The stronger will win in the end, but the stronger has to be found out first. If he should turn to and beat her—"
"Surely," I interrupted with a burning face and heart, "you do not seriously think that he is scoundrel enough for that, Mr. Jaggers?"
"I didn't say so, Pip. I am putting a case. If he should turn to and beat her, he may possibly get the strength on his side. If it should be a question of intellect, he certainly will not. It would be chance work to give an opinion how a fellow of that sort will turn out in such circumstances, because it's a toss-up between 2 results.
"May I ask what they are?"
"A fellow like our friend the Spider," answered Mr. Jaggers, "either beats or cringes. He may cringe and growl, or cringe and not growl. But he either beats or cringes. Ask Wemmick his opinion.
Either beats or cringes, said Wemmick, not at all addressing himself to me.
So here's to Mrs. Bentley Drummle, said Mr. Jaggers, taking a decanter of choicer wine from his dumb waiter, and filling for each of us and for himself. And may the question of supremacy be settled to the lady's satisfaction. To the satisfaction of the lady and the gentleman, it never will be. Now, Molly, 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 how slow you are today.
She was at his elbow when he addressed her, putting a dish upon the table, and as she withdrew her hands from it, she fell back a step or two, nervously muttering some excuse. And a certain action of her fingers as she spoke arrested my attention.
"What's the matter?" said Mr. Jaggers.
"Nothing. Only the subject we were speaking of," said I, "was rather painful to me." The action of her fingers was like the action of knitting. She stood looking at her master, not understanding whether she was free to go or whether he had more to say to her, and would call her back if she did go. Her look was very intent. Surely I had seen exactly such eyes and such hands on a memorable occasion lately. He dismissed her, and she glided out of the room. But she remained before me, as plainly as if she were still there. I looked at those hands, I looked at those eyes, I looked at that flowing hair, and I compared them with other hands, other eyes, other hair that I knew of. And with what those might be after 20 years of a brutal husband and a stormy life. I looked again at those hands and eyes of the housekeeper, and thought of the inexplicable feeling that had come over me when I last walked, not alone, in the ruined garden and through the deserted brewery. I thought how the same feeling had come back when I saw a face looking at me and a hand waving to me from a stagecoach window. And how it had come back again and had flashed about me like lightning when I had passed in a carriage, not alone, through a sudden glare of light in a dark street. I thought how one link of association had helped that identification in the theatre, and how such a link, wanting before, had been riveted for me now when I had passed by a chance swift from Estella's name to the fingers with their knitting action and the attentive eyes. And I felt absolutely certain that this woman was Estella's mother. Mr. Jaggers had seen me with Estella, and was not likely to have missed the sentiments I had been at no pains to conceal. He nodded when I said the subject was painful to me, clapped me on the back, put round the wine again, and went on with his dinner. Only twice more did the housekeeper reappear, and then her stay in the room was very short, and Mr. Jaggers was sharp with her. But her hands were Estella's hands, and her eyes were Estella's eyes, and if she had reappeared 100 times, I could have been neither more sure nor less sure that my conviction was the truth. It was a dull evening, for Wemmick drew his wine when it came round, quite as a matter of business, just as he might have drawn his salary when that came round, and with his eyes on his chief, sat in a state of perpetual readiness for cross-examination. As to the quantity of wine, his post office was as indifferent and ready as any other post office for its quantity of letters. From my point of view, he was the wrong twin all the time, and only externally like the Wemmick of Woolworth. We took our leave early and left together. Even when we were groping among Mr. Jagger's stock of boots for our hats, I felt that the right twin was on his way back, and we had not gone 6 yards down Gerrard Street in the Woolworth direction before I found that I was walking arm in arm with the right twin, and that the wrong twin had evaporated into the evening air.
"Well," said Wemmick, "that's over. He's a wonderful man without his living likeness, but I feel that I have to screw myself up when I dine with him, and I dine more comfortably unscrewed."
I felt that this was a good statement of the case, and told him so.
"Wouldn't say it to anybody but yourself," he answered. "I know that what is said between you and me goes no further."
I asked him if he had ever seen Miss Havisham's adopted daughter, Mrs. Bentley Drummle. He said no. To avoid being too abrupt, I then spoke of the aged and of Miss Skivins. He looked rather sly when I mentioned Miss Skivins, and stopped in the street to blow his nose with a roll of the head and a flourish not quite free from latent boastfulness.
"Wemmick,"
said I. "Do you remember telling me before I first went to Mr. Jagger's private house to notice that housekeeper?"
"Did I?" he replied. "Ah, I dare say I did. Deuce take me," he added sullenly. "I know I did. I find I am not quite unscrewed yet."
"A wild beast tamed, you called her.
And what did you call her?"
"The same. How did Mr. Jaggers tame her, Wemmick?"
"That's his secret. She has been with him many a long year.
I wish you would tell me her story. I feel a particular interest in being acquainted with it. You know that what is said between you and me goes no further."
"Well," Wemmick replied, "I don't know her story. That is, I don't know all of it. But what I do know, I'll tell you. We are in our private and personal capacities, of course."
"Of course."
"A score or so of years ago, that woman was tried at the Old Bailey for murder, and was acquitted. She was a very handsome young woman, and I believe had some gypsy blood in her. Anyhow, it was hot enough when it was up, as you may suppose.
But she was acquitted."
"Mr. Jaggers was for her," pursued Wemmick, with a look full of meaning, "and worked the case in a way quite astonishing. It was a desperate case, and it was comparatively early days with him then, and he worked it to general admiration. In fact, it may almost be said to have made him. He worked it himself at the police office, day after day for many days, contending against even a committal, and at the trial, where he couldn't work it himself, sat under counsel, and, everyone knew, put in all the salt and pepper. The murdered person was a woman a good 10 years older, very much larger and very much stronger. It was a case of jealousy. They both led tramping lives, and this woman in Gerrard Street here had been married very young over the broomstick, as we say, to a tramping man, and was a perfect fury in point of jealousy. The murdered woman, more a match for the man, certainly in point of years, was found dead in a barn near Hounslow Heath. There had been a violent struggle, perhaps a fight. She was bruised and scratched and torn, and had been held by the throat at last and choked. Now, there was no reasonable evidence to implicate any person but this woman, and on the improbabilities of her having been able to do it, Mr. Jaggers principally rested his case." "You may be sure," said Wemmick, touching me on the sleeve, "that he never dwelt upon the strength of her hands then, though he sometimes does now."
I told Wemmick of his showing us her wrists that day of the dinner party.
"Well, sir," Wemmick went on, "it happened. Happened, don't you see, that this woman was so very artfully dressed from the time of her apprehension that she looked much slighter than she really was. In particular, her sleeves are always remembered to have been so skilfully contrived that her arms had quite a delicate look. She had only a bruise or two about her, nothing for a tramp, but the backs of her hands were lacerated, and the question was it with fingernails? Now, Mr. Jaggers showed that she had struggled through a lot of brambles which were not as high as her face, but which she could not have got through and kept her hands out of. And bits of those brambles were actually found in her skin and put in evidence, as well as the fact that the brambles in question were found on examination to have been broken through and to have little shreds of her dress and little spots of blood upon them here and there. But the boldest point he made was this. It was attempted to be set up in proof of her jealousy that she was under strong suspicion of having, at about the time of the murder, frantically destroyed her child by this man, some 3 years old, to revenge herself upon him. Mr. Jaggers worked that in this way. We say these are not marks of fingernails, but marks of brambles, and we show you the brambles. You say they are marks of fingernails, and you set up the hypothesis that she destroyed her child. You must accept all consequences of that hypothesis. For anything we know, she may have destroyed her child, and the child, in clinging to her, may have scratched her hands. What then? You are not trying her for the murder of her child. Why don't you? As to this case, if you will have scratches, we say that, for anything we know, you may have accounted for them, assuming, for the sake of argument, that you have not invented them.
To sum up, sir, said Wemmick, Mr. Jaggers was altogether too many for the jury, and they gave in.
Has she been in his service ever since?
Yes, but not only that, said Wemmick. She went into his service immediately after her acquittal, tamed as she is now. She has since been taught one thing and another in the way of her duties, but she was tamed from the beginning.
Do you remember the sex of the child?
Said to have been a girl.
You have nothing more to say to me tonight?
Nothing. I got your letter and destroyed it. Nothing.
We exchanged a cordial good night, and I went home with new matter for my thoughts, though with no relief from the old.
Chapter 49. Putting Miss Havisham's note in my pocket, that it might serve as my credentials for so soon reappearing at Satis House, in case her waywardness should lead her to express any surprise at seeing me, I went down again by the coach the next day. But I alighted at the halfway house, and breakfasted there, and walked the rest of the distance, for I sought to get into the town quietly by the unfrequented ways, and to leave it in the same manner. The best light of the day was gone when I passed along the quiet, echoing courts behind the high street. The nooks of ruin where the old monks had once had their refectories and gardens, and where the strong walls were now pressed into the service of humble sheds and stables, were almost as silent as the old monks in their graves. The cathedral chimes had at once a sadder and a more remote sound to me, as I hurried on, avoiding observation, than they had ever had before. So the swell of the old organ was borne to my ears like funeral music, and the rooks, as they hovered about the grey tower and swung in the bare high trees of the priory garden, seemed to call to me that the place was changed, and that Estella was gone out of it for ever. An elderly woman, whom I'd seen before as one of the servants who lived in the supplementary house across the back courtyard, opened the gate. The lighted candle stood in the dark passage within, as of old, and I took it up and ascended the staircase alone. Miss Havisham was not in her own room, but was in the larger room across the landing. Looking in at the door, after knocking in vain, I saw her sitting on the hearth in a ragged chair close before, and lost in the contemplation of the ashy fire. Doing as I had often done, I went in and stood, touching the old chimney-piece, where she could see me when she raised her eyes. There was an air of utter loneliness upon her that would have moved me to pity, though she had wilfully done me a deeper injury than I could charge her with. As I stood compassionating her, and thinking how, in the progress of time, I too had come to be a part of the wretched fortunes of the house, her eyes rested on me. She stared, and said in a low voice, "Is it real?" "It is I, Pip. Mr. Jaggers gave me your note yesterday, and I have lost no time."
"Thank you. Thank you."
As I brought another of the ragged chairs to the hearth and sat down, I remarked a new expression on her face, as if she were afraid of me.
"I want," she said, "to pursue that subject you mentioned to me when you were last here, and to show you that I am not all stone. But perhaps you can never believe now that there is anything human in my heart."
When I said some reassuring words, she stretched out her tremulous right hand as though she was going to touch me. But she recalled it again before I understood the action or knew how to receive it.
"You said, speaking for your friend, that you could tell me how to do something useful and good. Something that you would like done, is it not?"
"Something that I would like done very, very much."
"What is it?"
I began explaining to her that secret history of the partnership. I had not got far into it when I judged from her looks that she was thinking in a discursive way of me, rather than of what I said. It seemed to be so, for when I stopped speaking, many moments passed before she showed that she was conscious of the fact.
"Do you break off?"
she asked then, with her former air of being afraid of me.
"Because you hate me too much to bear to speak to me?"
"No, no," I answered. "How can you think so, Miss Havisham? I stopped because I thought you were not following what I said."
"Perhaps I was not," she answered, putting her hand to her head. "Begin again, and let me look at something else.